Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It's Friday, which means we take some time to dive deeper beneath the headlines of the big story of the week. And this week, it was tragic.
It started around 2:30 Saturday afternoon in the parking lot of this Tops Friendly Market store in a predominantly black neighborhood in Buffalo.
Next thing you know, you just kept hearing boom, boom, boom. And you hear them coming inside the store. And all we could do was just drop to the ground.
As more details emerged, it became clear the attack was not random, but thoroughly planned and motivated by hate.
Just before heading to the market, he's believed to have written and posted a 180-page statement, proudly labeling himself a white supremacist and outlining the attack.
Understandably, the community is still reeling.
People just wake up and come kill us whenever they feel like it, and that's not okay.
Sound there from NBC News and CNN. President Biden tried to deliver some hope while speaking in Buffalo on Tuesday.
In America, evil will not win, I promise you. Hate will not prevail. And white supremacy will not have the last word.
Here in Boston, emotions hit hard. Here's how Reverend Willie Bodrick II, senior pastor at the 12th Baptist Church, talked about the tragedy with his congregation.
As I told them Sunday, we're grappling with our faith and our frustrations. How do you manage those moments? How do you deal with those times? How do you process the trauma, whether near or far? How do you grapple with the fact that we no longer have safe spaces?
How do you do that? And how do you do it here? Here in our greater Boston community, here to help us grapple with that, two folks who've been a part of life in Boston for a long time and know our community well. Tito Jackson is a former Boston City Councilor, CEO and founder of Apex Noir Cannabis, and as of yesterday, one of the inaugural members of the new Boston Commission on Black Men and Boys. Tito, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And Joan Vanacki, assistant editor and columnist for the Boston Globe. Joan wrote a piece this week with the headline, "How many white Americans will do anything more than shake their heads about the Buffalo Massacre?" Joan, thanks for coming in as
well. Thanks for asking me.
I appreciate it. So I want to start with the where were you question, Tito. Where were you and what were you thinking when you first heard the news?
Just with my nephew. This phrase, "this is not who we are," is the antithesis of what is happening. This is who we are as a country. This actually happened multiple times. It's also frustrating to me that the descriptions of white assailants are usually to give their background and how nice or quiet they were in school and whether or not people picked on them or not. It pissed me off. It just made me very, very angry. As a black person in this country, the things that actually continue to happen to us in our communities, in particular in this case where this is targeted, this individual knew the demographic data in order to drive across the country, live stream this. And the first pieces people begin to talk about are his mental health. And I guess the last piece is he was unharmed, unblemished. And you had a police officer who had his arm on his kind of right shoulder. And I just think about the number of black folk who've been shot in the back in traffic stops. Breonna Taylor, who was sleeping. And just the number of black folks who die time and time again at the hands of police, and this individual who killed 10 people literally had not a blemish on him.
Tito, I want to underscore what you're saying before I come to you, Joan. Reverend Bodrick was in on Wednesday. He was here for a leadership conversation. We're doing a series called Stepping Up, where we're talking about people who make change in their community. But we started in this place, and I asked him the question about what he was thinking and feeling on Saturday, and I want to play that.
To be very honest with you, I was very angry this weekend, frustrated, but also angered, because we've seen the signs of this type of white supremacist violence and ideology not only be perpetuated, but end up with lives lost. And if you put it in the grander context of American history, this isn't a new thing. It's just new in its form here in our particular context.
So, Joan, it was really striking to me to then read your piece on what I might call the Great White American Shrug. So I want to ask you where you were when you heard the news and what made you decide to write. I mean, you can write about anything.
Right. I had spent the afternoon helping my son. I was doing some babysitting for him, and because he's working on a house in New Hampshire. I saw it on Twitter first, and when I got home, I did what I would normally do. I turned on CNN, and I happened to tune in just when they were doing the press conference with the usual lineup of officials talking about what had happened and responding to questions from the press. And I felt, my first reaction was that this was disgusting and disturbing, and it felt like a kick in the gut. But my second instinct was to turn it off, that I felt like I had seen this, heard this before, and I knew exactly the script that was going to follow. I knew exactly what the officials were going to say. I knew exactly what was going to happen, what Tito described, who the assailant was, you know, the background, the story about how he got the gun. I knew what the talking heads were going to say. And I sort of stood there and said to myself, I'm not going to write about it. Because my deadline is Monday morning, I usually spend a part of the weekend trying to figure out what I'm going to write about. And I just thought, I'm not going to write about it because there's nothing more that I could say. And I often feel now that I'm not the right person to say it anyway. That changed as the weekend went on. I started to feel, why am I avoiding this? Why don't I want to think about it? And maybe I should just sort of write about my own reaction. And what really made me write about it was the piece in the New York Times where I saw this bishop from Buffalo who sort of exhorted his fellow religious leaders and said, if you don't stand up and say something, you're not my friend. We need you to speak out about it. And I thought he was letting the rest of us off the hook in a way, and that I would try to write about it, and that in a way I was kind of tracking my own reaction. Maybe the headline should have been memo to myself, or maybe Tito would have put the headline, white people problems. I don't know, but I decided to give it a try.
So, Tito, I'm just, people can't see the connection, the eye contact between the two of you, the way you were physically reacting while Joan was speaking. So I'm just going to let you jump in.
I want to thank Joan for using her big voice. And she is one of the most prolific columnists that we have in the city of Boston. But I reflect on, and we're at BU right now, I reflect on one of the graduates here, MLK, and he said, in the end, we will not remember the words of our enemy, but the silence of our friends. In the end, we will not remember the words of our enemy, but the silence of our friends. We have to, and I implore you, as white folks, to step up and have these conversations. I am not in your at your Thanksgiving table, your birthday party, and someone as amazingly inspirational as Willie Broderick is not there on a regular basis. These conversations, you know, this young man, had he been Muslim, we would have asked, what cell did he come from? Where was he radicalized, right? Well, this is a young white gentleman who, in this case, came from someplace. He came from a family. He came from a community and the like. And so we have to really begin to think about 3 out of 4 of the domestic terrorist acts come from right-wing extremists. We need to look at this in historic context. This is the worst massacre since Tulsa, Oklahoma, of black folk in the United States. And I saw—
Just for listeners, the Tulsa race massacre of Black Wall Street in Tulsa in the early 1900s. Yep. Go ahead. Sorry.
And I saw a gentleman, Rasan Ray, from the Brookings Institute, and he said that, you know, hate groups need to be classified as gangs. to allow them to be investigated. And we need to take take all of this into account. Lastly, Sandy Hook, I think about this and juxtapose.
School shooting.
Sandy Hook school shooting, 28 people were killed, but 20 white babies, 20 white babies who were 6 and 7 years old were killed, and nothing was done. So as a black person, when I look at black folk, and you see there was a video where he skipped over a white person, it really begs the question who we are, where we are, and how do we get out of this? And I would submit it is going to require white folks to step up and have very uncomfortable conversations and do what Joan did, not turn it off, but switch it on to have the conversations with people you disagree with and you have difficulties with.
So
we have to.
Joan, I'm going to come to you just to clarify a couple of things. The shooter wore some kind of a GoPro-style camera and was broadcasting on Twitch until it was quickly brought down. He shot 13 people. 11 of them were black. 10 died, just for our listeners who may not know that whole picture. Joan, you wanted to jump right in. Go ahead.
Well, what I wanted to respond to was speaking out. Yes, I think it's important, and I'm not going to try to speak for all white people here, but I feel there is a fear now of saying the wrong thing. And Tito, you sort of went down the list of what the wrong thing is. And I know it. Don't call him a teenager, you know, because a black 18-year-old would be called a black man, not a black teenager. Don't call him troubled, because a black 18-year-old who's involved in violence, we're not, white people don't see it as troubled. They see it as something different.
As violent.
I know, right. I know the code words, but I think that if you make people afraid of saying anything, then that's an incentive to say nothing. I also think that it's important to try to understand how troubled teenager internet leads to white supremacy. Maybe that's naive on my part that I don't get it. Maybe it's Pollyanna-ish of me to think that trying to understand it can somehow head it off or change it. But, I mean, that's kind of where I'm coming from in my sometimes reticence now to tackle a topic. I started out by saying I've started to feel maybe I'm not the right person to do it because I'm a white woman of a certain age and background. And maybe I shouldn't be discouraged from taking it on. The way to have change is to build coalitions, and that's what makes change happen.
Yeah, so a couple of thoughts there, and I'm going to bring it back to you, Tito. First, it does particularly strike me that white women of a certain age, and I'm entering that age myself, have a very specific conversation we should have here in this moment. And we can talk about the history of white women and black America and the roles we have and haven't played, but I think it behooves us to sit in the discomfort the way you did with the column. You know, I got a text from a really close friend on Monday saying, what are you going to do about this story? Not are you covering it, but what are you going to do about this story? And of course, my first reaction was, we're Radio Boston. We stay very local. We're working very hard to be about our community. And then I realized our community needs to have this conversation. Our team realized that, which is why we are trying right here at this table to model a Boston conversation about something that happened in Buffalo. And that feels like sitting with that discomfort, especially white people who I think are not necessarily good at talking about race or versed in talking about race. It's time to take on that mantle of discomfort. And I know I'm opinionating more than I probably should, but this is us at our table together, Tito.
White supremacy is real. When you listen to replacement theory, you need to really listen to what folk are saying. And when you listen to what replacement theory is, which is saying basically all these brown folks are going to take over our country, to me, that's actually, it's even deeper than that because I actually look at it as genetic. When you listen to people from the Klan, they're talking about essentially white genetic annihilation based on the fact that there's quote-unquote race mixing, right? as well as the number of people of color that are being born. So it's
and just to note, there's history in the 20th century of those kinds of arguments. You're not pulling this out of nowhere. No. There's history there.
Right. And so we are reverting back to, and we've heard folks, particularly on Fox News, you know, really push these conversations. And so what I would say is it is absolutely critical at this time as a country that we have these conversations. I also feel like, and when we listen to, you know, really the attack on women with Roe v. Wade, but understand some of the premise of Roe v. Wade is the 14th Amendment, right? And that connectivity. And as a man, I have to step up and say that I believe it is right for a woman to have the right to choose. And that's how change happens. If white folks stand aside, and if someone as powerful as Joan Vernanke does not write and use what she's able to do and the ink that she's able to purvey in this, then we cannot and will not move forward as a country. And the question is, are we going to move forward or are we going to revert backward? And I would submit to you right now, a lot of the conversations that I'm having are conversations that are pulling us back rather than forward. When I see a 9-year-old kid with a video going to a black kid's door with a whip and whipping, there was a story, I believe this is in Texas, where there was a 9-year-old who went to their neighbor's house with a whip and was whipping the door of the home of a black child. These young people come from some place. These are cultural cues, and they are being raised in this fashion. And so we have to have these conversations. We are in a country where people are trying to change textbooks, and to really push a specific mantra onto our children when it comes to social studies and history. We have to continue to have these conversations, and they result in outcomes such as Buffalo.
So, Joan, with Tito's words still ringing in our ears, one of the things that strikes me about your work over time is that you're good at saying, here's who needs to step up and how. As you think about after writing this piece and with the feedback you've gotten this week, are there individuals, institutions that have a particular opportunity or a particular responsibility to step forward here in Greater Boston in this moment, facilitate these conversations, participate in these conversations, create spaces for discomfort and stand in it? Have you thought about that?
I actually haven't thought about it from the Boston piece. I've thought about it, I guess, from more of a national platform. I mean, Tito mentioned Martin Luther King. I keep on listening for some voice. There are powerful local voices, of course. You know, Tito is one of them. There are many. I'm listening for a voice from on the national front that can get people from both sides to pay attention. I mean, that is the problem right now, right? We're kind of, I think conversations are great. We should have them. They're uncomfortable. They're painful. But we need to have them. But how do you get from the conversation to change? In 2008, which now seems like another century, I thought Barack Obama was that voice for the country. People in a moment in time listened to him. He got people from blue states, red states, to somehow believe they were purple states. We definitely are way past that, and I don't think he's the voice who could do it anymore. He did what he could. But so who is the next person? I don't know. I almost feel like it has to come from the so-called other side.
So I
would submit, and what I say to folks when it comes to running for elected office, if you don't see someone who represents the perspective that you you feel or need, you need to run for office yourself. And I would submit that this it is problematic, actually, to look for a MLK or a Gandhi. They're gone and they're dead. And typically, we look for those individuals. And our young people, I think, have done a better thing where it's broad-based. And we have to look at it not from the perspective of a leader, but leaders and a movement that changes things. When we look at the Arab Spring, they didn't have any one individual leader that toppled many of these countries. So what I would say to you is that this is not Democrat and Republican. This is white supremacy and those who stand idly by, either who step forward and fight it or those who stand idly by and acquiesce and are apathetic when it comes to it. And I would submit we have to have white leadership who gets off the bystander list and to step forward and have these conversations in coalition with people of color. We can't. This hurts. This is stressful this week. Seeing black bodies harmed does me physically harm. I've been calling my massage therapist all week, that is something that we as black folk also deal with. We're looked at oftentimes for leadership in these situations. We're tired. We're stressed out. And this is a huge burden to bear to see those bodies of us, a reflection of us on the ground, and then only to also have others not take up their proverbial cross and to do the work that needs to be done. So we should be looking within and not outside of ourselves to be the agents of change.
I hear you. And I guess I have two reactions. I mean, I don't go to a grocery store and think that somebody is going to hunt me down and kill me. So to grapple with what you're grappling with is outside my life experience. Historically, in this country, there was a movement, the civil rights movement of the 60s, which I think did what you're talking about, mobilized black and white Americans towards a goal. And we don't want to, it does feel like someone's trying to turn the clock back. So how do we stop them? I wish I was smart enough to know the answer to that question, but I don't, I'm not.
I think I'm going to leave it there. And I appreciate both of you being at the table today to begin today's conversation from a news event that happened in Buffalo, but that we know is challenging us so deeply here in our greater Boston community. And I feel real gratitude. The last voice you heard was Joan Vanacki, associate editor and columnist for the Boston Globe. You can find a link to her piece on the Buffalo shooting at our website, radioboston.org, and Tito Jackson, former Boston City Councilor, CEO and founder of Apex Noir Cannabis, and as of yesterday, an inaugural member of a commission he's been trying for years, Boston's Commission on Black Men and Boys. Thanks, both of you, for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
When you think of video games, you probably think of something like this. Gaming can be stressful, as Zelda fans will attest from the sound we just heard. But now, wait a minute. What about this? That is the sound of a child calming her emotions through a breathing exercise and the reward she receives from a video game for doing it. Yep, you heard the whole sentence right. It is from a YouTube review of a new video game focused on children's mental health and well-being. Mightier, the game, is the creation of researchers at Boston University, Boston Children's Hospital and Harvard Medical School. And using gaming and biometric feedback, it helps kids learn how to regulate emotion. Jason Kahn is a researcher from Boston Children's Hospital and is co-founder and chief science officer of Mightier. He's here in the studio now. Welcome, Jason.
Thank you. Nice to meet you, Tiziana.
It's great to have you here. So first, I actually just want you to start by helping our listeners understand how this works. I sort of got it,
yes. But
seeing it made a difference. So talk us through how this thing actually works.
Yeah. The place I like to start is to really frame and set the stage that Mightier works to build the skill called emotional regulation for children. And emotional regulation is the skill that you use when you take on frustration or challenge or these difficult moments and really persevere and stay through those moments. It's a lifelong skill and it's valuable for all of us. What Mightier does is it lets kids see their emotions in real time. They wear a heart rate monitor while they play. And
the around their wrist.
Yeah, around
right?
their wrist.
They
yes.
put this bracelet
yep.
on.
And what that does is it gives them a window into their emotions during video game play. And then what Mightier does is you go into these video games and it really turns the experience on its head. So video games in and of themselves, they have all these moments of challenge, just like life. But when those moments of challenge come inside of Mightier, Mightier actually makes the game harder, which throws most adults for a loop. But if you're a child in that moment, what you're incentivized to do is you're incentivized to figure out how to calm down, to make that game easier again. And Mightier will give you help. It'll help you deep breathe. It will help you do progressive muscle relaxation. But then with that moment of practice, you've proven for yourself that you can calm down. And kids get to do that hundreds of times inside of Mightier, and it becomes automatic over time.
So what happens, so a child gets a bracelet. They come, the bracelet comes in a box. They wear it. It's sort of like a like a Fitbit would be. And then there's this tablet, and it's kind of colorful and bubbly. And the games are things like, what, a plane flying?
Yeah, exactly. They're actually the same type of games that you'd play on your phone or your tablet or even your Xbox, right? So there's games like a plane flying. That game's called Race the Sun. There's a game called Mini Metro, which a lot of adults have played on the App Store. We're close to adding a game called Temple Run, which a lot of parents will know.
Like, I know Temple Run.
Yeah, exactly. So they're games. They're fun games that you play. And what you do is we take these games and we just add on top of them. So we know that kids are having fun inside of these games, and they're choosing the ones that work for them and match their experience. And then they use those games to build these skills.
So earlier this week, we did a segment on stress, and we had a stress researcher and then a woman who specializes in yoga and meditation. And she was talking about, you know, deep breathing and grounding yourself, et cetera. And there are actually techniques, right? So it did seem cruel to me at first that as the kid's heart rate goes up and the monitor picks it up, you freak them out on purpose, which I was like, that is just not nice. But then the video game itself actually teaches kids these techniques and gives room to pause the game and try them?
Yeah, it absolutely does. And I mean, even to that point, like, I think a lot of grownups, like, you think, oh my goodness, it gets harder in that moment. But the second we back up to a challenge that we faced, we all have this. I mean, we have an argument, we have a disagreement, whatever. We're facing something that's uncomfortable. Our emotions make that experience harder. Our emotions make that harder.
And how?
Yes. And so reflecting that in a video game is just like reflecting life back to a child. And then, yes, just like you said, the child can take a pause and they can see, they can do deep breathing right then and there. And they can see, they can watch their emotions come back down.
So literally, is there like some display that shows their heart rate slowing or?
Exactly. So there is a, we call it the gizmo in the game language, but it follows the kids everywhere they go and they get to see their heart rate. They get to see it go up, 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 up as they face the challenge. And then as they take the deep breaths, they get to see it come back down.
And then the game gets easier.
Then the game gets easier.
So there's motivation to bring that heart rate back down.
Absolutely.
Because then you can succeed.
Mm-hmm.
Which, of course, the life lesson in that is kind of sitting right here.
It's huge. It's huge. And what's amazing about it is it becomes automatic over time, right? So if you put yourself in the shoes of a 10-year-old boy or a 10-year-old girl who is struggling, who might have ADHD or anxiety and has not faced a lot of success when they face these challenges, and then all of a sudden they see themselves. They realize they have this strength. They have this power. They can calm themselves back down. And they do it. They deep breathe. They do it. But then the next time it comes, they deep breathe. And then they do it. But then they get to this point where they don't even have to press. It's a button in the game. They don't even have to press the button. They know. They can deep breathe. And then you get to a point. They don't even know what they're doing.
They just do it.
They just do it.
Now, you ran several rounds of trials on this. This is research-backed. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. So we have run, as you pointed out in the introduction, my background is in academic medicine, academic psychiatry at Boston Children's Hospital. And at the hospital setting itself, we ran multiple randomized controlled trials and looked at how kids who come in with emotional regulation challenges, how their symptoms change over time. And so what we were able to see is reductions in anger, reductions in aggression, reductions in disruptive behaviors. The other piece that was always really powerful to me and really led to the commercial creation of Mightier was a reduction in parent stress. Because
now tell me about that.
Yeah, I mean that's what's exciting, right? Because a lot of times you put tools in front of kids and they get really, really good at the thing, but then it doesn't transfer off into their life. And for us to be able to say, for parents to be able to say, look, like I have this video game in my I have this video game in my child's life, and I am feeling less stressed. We knew we had something. We knew we had something that could make a difference in a lot of people's lives. That was just the beginning, though. So that was, we left the hospital 6 years ago, and now at this point, we've been in 50,000 homes.
So we're talking with Jason Kahn, who is a researcher from Boston Children's Hospital, but co-founder and chief science officer of Mightier, which is this game that we're talking about that helps kids learn emotional self-regulation. Is this for any child? Is the target audience here children who are particularly struggling with emotional dysregulation? Who's your market?
Absolutely. So one of the things I'd like to point out is that every single child, every single human can get better at emotional regulation. There is no starting line and there is no end line. And so no matter who you are, there is some room to improve. Mightier itself really works best for kids who are 6 to 12. These are the types of video games that we've put onto Mightier. And a lot of our kids do have diagnoses like ADHD or autism, but it really is, I mean, all children can benefit. It's just that with those groups of children, we know that there is room to benefit. And, you know, beyond that, we know there's right now, especially pandemic, there's a lot of wait for services.
So I want to talk about the screen time irony of this, right? We've been told for years, avoid screen time for kids, avoid video games for kids, don't put the kid on the screen. Now, a lot changed during the pandemic when kids did remote schooling and were forced onto screens. But, you know, for example, one study reported by the University of Colorado Boulder noted that kids who spent more time in front of screens slept worse, got poorer grades, showed greater signs of behaviors like we might see in ADHD, for example. So here's a screen, which some people would say causes some of the emotional dysregulation. You're saying, no, use the screen for emotional
Absolutely.
Regulation.
I mean, with screens, we always have to think about how we want to use them and how we want to be intentional with them. So if we think, if we buy into this idea that screens can cause behavior change, then we as the creators, we as the people who are making the content, get to decide what that behavior change is going to be. And so when you take something like Mightier, that's built from the ground up that when you experience, when you go into that world, you are going to see your emotions. You're going to be rewarded for using your emotions. You're going to be rewarded for playing with your emotions and really building this skill that wouldn't otherwise exist. If you go into another screen if you go into another screen setting, the designers might have a different intent. And, you know, as I'm a parent too, but as a parent, you have to just have to think, like, what do I want my child to get out of their experiences on the screen? And how do I want to make choices around, you know, really thinking about it like a screen time diet, like what's right and what amount of, you know, what amount of each type of experience do I want to
It's what they're doing offer. With the screen.
Exactly.
Is it affordable? I mean, if it works the way you say it does, and I don't mean that like an I don't believe you, right? Is it, lots of families could use this.
Yeah, absolutely. So right now it is, it's a subscription based, you can go on and it's a service that anyone can buy. I think one of the things that's exciting that we've been doing recently is we've been working with insurance companies trying to make it more accessible, trying to build out access to this.
Health insurance companies? That
health
kind of insurance
Yes, health
company?
Insurance companies. Because they're interested in this story because, like I said earlier, there's just so much demand for mental health services, especially post-pandemic. Like, how do we get more kids more access right now? We're running a trial, actually, with the NIH, which is another way families can get involved if they're
National
interested.
National Institutes of Health.
Yes. So there are multiple ways to get involved with Mightier. You can go buy it, but there are other ways as well.
And so maybe someday a therapeutic intervention that's funded by an insurance company.
Yes, absolutely.
All right. That is Jason Kahn, co-founder and chief science officer of Mightier. Jason, thanks for coming in and telling us about it.
Thank you.
Go ahead. Again, hold on.
Okay.
Take your time.
This is very narrow.
Yes.
Okay, so in all fairness, I could manage the stairs just fine, thank you, but they were super narrow. That is me climbing the steeple of Boston's Old North Church back in 2019. Yes, they were narrow because they were from Paul Revere's time. These are the famous one if by land, two if by sea stairs, and the signal was raised there as the starting point of his midnight ride of legend. Now, almost 300 years old, the church is the oldest surviving church building in our city, and it's one of the most visited sites along Boston's Freedom Trail. Well, today we want to talk about a new chapter in that 300-year-old church. For the first and only time in those three centuries, the church has hired a woman as its sexton, or the church's caretaker, and her name is Chelsea Millsap. She joins us right here in Studio 2. Welcome, Chelsea.
Hi, thank you. It's good to be here.
When was the first time you walked up those stairs?
It was about a month ago during my interview. I wasn't expecting it, but it was amazing.
Describe them a little bit.
Well, they're very narrow and kind of put together with like a bunch of different old pieces of wood. And so, and each path is kind of different from the one before, just how it's put together. And so it's interesting. You really have to pay attention to where you're stepping when you climb up there. But it's amazing when you get to the top and look out over the city.
And can you see the whole city from there?
Yes. Yes, you can. It's beautiful.
So you're the steward now. You are the caretaker of those stairs and everything else in that building, including, as I understand it, a lot of old congregation members, and we'll talk more about the crypt in a minute, but buried under the church. What does it mean to be the segment, the sexton?
It's very special for me. I love history, and especially early American history. I'm descended from Mary Chilton, who was the first female off of the Mayflower. So to be the first sexton at Old North, it just sort of seems like a full circle experience. It's very special to me.
And so, how does a sexton spend their day?
Oh, it's every day is different than the last. Most of it is maintenance, just property management. But we do have several big projects coming up in the next few years. We've got the crypt project coming up in a couple of weeks, which we're lowering the floor of the crypt. So that will be really exciting. And also throughout my day, traditionally a sexton is also like the crypt keeper. So because we're not putting any, we're not using the actual crypt itself, we have a section called the columbarium, which people can buy spots in there and be buried there. So my job is to sort of inter those ashes and prepare them for their final resting place.
And why are you moving the floor of the crypt there? Just, again, about 1,100 people there, including the church's first minister, Reverend Timothy Cutler, and Captain Samuel Nicholson, who was the first commander of the USS Constitution. Why mess with it at all? Why move anything?
To make the experience accessible for everyone. So it's also the ceiling is very low in there, too. So it really does, it'll make it accessible to all people.
And so that's really kind of the point here, right, is that the church is changing in its 300-year history. And I should note, the sound that we played at the top, that was from a story that then-producer Walter Wuthman and I were doing with the church as it was reckoning with its history of slavery. This is a church that's trying to connect the past 300 years ago to today. And here you come, a project manager, former firefighter, who now is what we historically would have seen in a man's job, mm-hmm. doing property management on this historic legend in our city. Why even take the job, and what do you think you bring to it?
I would be so upset to pass up this opportunity. It really is such a special place. And one of the things that I do every day since I've been here is that I look for like those shared experiences, like you were talking about. The church has changed over the last 300 years, but there are certain things about it that do connect you to the past and to everybody who has walked through those doors, including the enslaved, including like Lafayette, including Paul Revere, including the Queen of England who has visited in the past. Like, it's just like the organ, the bells, the clock, those are all audible experiences that tie us to those people. Those, everybody that has walked through the doors has heard that the ticking of that clock. It's the oldest public clock in North America. So it's just, there's so many different experiences at Old North that just, it makes you feel like you're part of the history and that you're connected to all of the people that have been there. And so it's just really special to be in a position where I get to kind of curate that experience for people who come in the future.
Do you live there?
I do.
So, okay, I have to ask you. I mean, you've got 300 years of history. You've got a crypt underneath. It's a church, right? There's that ticking clock. What's it like to be alone there late at night? And does it, you know, I don't mean speak to you, but
yeah.
Does it speak to you?
In a way, it does. Like I said, I look for those connections and stuff like that. I would love to see a ghost, but I haven't yet. No, I'm not like afraid to be there at night or by myself or anything like that. But it does feel remarkable to be able to be like one of few who have been able to be the caretaker. It sort of feels like you're a lighthouse keeper in a way, and that those lanterns are still shining. And I don't know, it's just, it's very powerful. Feels great to be part of it.
That is really striking for you. That lighthouse keeper just really caught my attention. I mean, it is the place where Paul Revere helped hang the lanterns, right? The famous signal. And working with him was Robert Newman, the church's first sexton. So it has been a lighthouse of our collective story about revolution and freedom. It has been a lighthouse as a physical, spiritual presence in one of the older parts of Boston. What's the new lighthouse you think it can be? And what are you excited as a woman figuratively breaking ground there to be a part of going forward?
Well, the church and foundation have hired on a new researcher who is really diving into kind of the less known aspects of the church's history. And so to me, the fact that the church is investing so much time learning those different parts of our past that we don't even know about yet, I think that it can be a more collective experience for all kinds of people, and we're going to learn a lot more to come, and there's going to be a lot more to see at Old North. So I think that the light is just going to continue to shine.
And the biggest surprise for you in the job so far?
Oh, geez. The biggest surprise? I didn't know before I came here that Paul Revere was actually one of the bell ringers when he was a teenager. So that was a big surprise. But
Okay, but a lot of people don't know about the bell ringers, and this is pretty cool. So explain what it means to be a bell ringer in the church.
So, yeah, the bells were made in England, and I believe they were a gift of the king. And they didn't ring properly until Robert Newman and a bunch of other – he was 16 years old when him and a bunch of other kids signed a contract with the church to ring them every weekend. And so they properly rang them. For the first time when Paul Revere became a bell ringer. And they're called change ringing bells. They're the oldest change ringing bells in the nation. And there's just this particular pattern and different types of patterns that you can play.
And you stand up in the steeple
and pull on the ropes. And yep.
And there's like a whole pattern and system to it.
Yes.
Incredible. And Paul Revere as a teenager was one of those.
Yes.
Yeah, that's my big surprise today, too. All right, Chelsea Millsap is the first woman to hold the position of sexton at Boston's Old North Church. That was fun. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
Ladies and gentlemen, The Weeknd.
Oh, it is going to be a scorcher this weekend. It's going to get up into the 90s, but we're not going to let that heat stop us from making the most of the weekend. And so here to give us our rundown of some local events that you might be interested in, WBUR Senior Arts and Culture reporter Cristela Guerra. Cristela, welcome back.
Huh? Thanks, Tiziana.
So I understand that you have brought a great list for us, all kinds of things to do this weekend. And we're going to start by getting our veg on, right?
Yes. I have two words for you. Broccoli bar.
No.
Yes, there's going to be a broccoli bar in Worcester at the New England Veg Fest. It is on Sunday. It's from 12 to 5. I think it's a Worcester State University, and it is free, family-friendly, and I guess it's basically a celebration of vegetarians and vegans. You've got desserts, cooking demos, plant-based merchandise, whatever you need if you love vegetables.
Now, are you a broccoli fan? I was pretty firm in my no broccoli bar, thank you, but are you a broccoli fan?
I like broccoli. I like broccoli and I like Brussels sprouts. And I feel like that's a controversial opinion. And I like kale.
So this could be a good place for you. I will say I like all three of those raw. I'm not a huge fan of any of them cooked. All right. So off of our vegan preferences. Next up, you've got a couple of events down the block from one another in Salem. So tell us what's going on in Salem this weekend.
Oh, you've got choices, Tiziana. So there's PEM. There's the Peabody Essex Museum's Prize Festival. I saw it described as like nine streets filled with song. You've got musicians. You've got stages from about 12 to 6. Outdoor music. It's free. Also family friendly, thankfully. And I love flea markets. So you've got 40 collectors, artisans, just a lot of vintage. And I forgot to mention, so the festival actually honors an artist whose exhibition, I think, at the museum is made up of 40 recordings of street musicians. So that's why all the music.
And there will be street musicians performing around the town, yes?
All through Salem, yeah.
And for those who haven't been to Salem, it's this wonderfully walkable downtown. You've got a lot of cobblestone streets. You've got a lot of old houses with a little history on the front of them. And, of course, the kind of the constant presence of Halloween, even in the summer. But this would be a whole different way to encounter Salem, right, Cristela?
Absolutely. I am a big fan of that town. There's a lot happening.
All right. So it is going to be very, very, very warm. Give us something air-conditioned that we can do. I think you're going to take us to Harvard for that.
I am in Cambridge. So at the Harvard Museum of Natural History, there's an exhibit. It's called In Search of Thoreau's Flowers, An Exploration of Change and Loss. It's sort of it marries art and science. It uses digitized versions of Thoreau's botanical specimens. I think it's about 648. And they're trying to sort of strike up a conversation about what we're losing to climate change. So, the museum's open daily, 9 to 5.
So this is going to take, I mean, Thoreau, from a particular moment in our history, one where climate was not what we were talking about, they're actually going to take that collection and find a way to tie it to a conversation about climate change now?
Yeah, to bring it kind of present day and to really look at how he honored nature. I think it's going to be really intriguing. I want to check it out.
Okay, so our last item for this weekend also leans into the heat. Take us to the ocean.
So I've done this. It's Free Ferry Day. It's every year. And it's you have to really get there early. It's first come, first serve. So you could catch a boat at like 8 o'clock. They'll take you, I think, to Fort Warren on George's Island, or you could go to Spectacle Island's beaches, which are trails. Tiziana, have you been out there? It's really lovely.
It is gorgeous. So wait, so you go to Long Wharf North, is that
yes.
right? And you can just
Long Wharf North.
You can just get on a ferry and they'll take you to one of these beautiful places and you can spend some time there walking and enjoying nature?
From 8 to around 2 o'clock. They start returning, I think, after 2. So you really want to get there early enough to get there and come back.
So I know this is going to sound like a silly question, but when you're on the ferry, since you've done this one before, it's been a while since I've done it, do you get all that cool air and ocean breeze? Will it literally cool you off from the 90 or 95 degrees that we are going to be experiencing?
I think it did. I did it when I first moved here like 7 years ago. But what's funny is that I love the heat, so I don't understand why people are complaining.
Okay.
I'm very excited.
All right. So that
very gets, excited for the heat.
That gets me to my last question, which is interesting. So last week when I asked you what you really wanted to do for the weekend, it had been really cold. It was about to get warm. And you're like, I am going to lay in the grass. I was assuming you would not do that this weekend, but it sounds like you would still be a grass layer even in this heat.
Any time, except maybe in the rain and even then. But ice cream and the beach, or ice cream on the beach. That is like, that's what I have in mind for this weekend.
And what flavor?
Pistachio.
Oh, yeah, that sounds good. All right, WBUR yep. Senior Arts and Culture Reporter Cristela Guerra with some excellent ideas to get you out and enjoying yourself this weekend. Cristela, good to talk to you. Have a wonderful weekend.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our producers are Chris Siderick, Amanda Beland, and Sydney Bowles, with Francisca Monahan and Sarah Leeson. We also had help today from Maya Schwader. Marquise Neal is our technical director. Karen Schiffman is our interim executive producer. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again Monday for more Radio Boston.